Sumaya Keynes, thank you for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are literally a Keynesian economist in the sense that, like, you've got John Maynard up there in the family tree somewhere, right?
Yeah, was not. He did not have any children, and he died in 1946. So everyone needs to lower their expectations right now. Never met him. You know, he's obviously a legend, but wouldn't claim to be very close.
You are, of course, also an economist and a journalist. You wrote for The Economist for a while. Maybe you are The Economist, the mysterious economist. You're now writing at the Financial Times, where you also host The Economic Show with Sumaya Keynes. And you are the co-author of a new book. The reason why we're here talking today, the book is titled How to Win a Trade War. You are joining us from London, I believe. But over here on this side of the pond, we've got a fearless leader who famously said that trade wars are good and easy to win. True or false?
False.
And that, I suppose, is the point of the book. I've also heard from many people, though, that you can't win a trade war. No one wins a trade war. And yet here you've written a book that says it's a how-to guide to winning a trade war. At least in theory, that implies that winning one is possible. Can we win a trade war?
Yeah. Okay. So no one wins a trade war. Trade wars are ugly. They are dirty. They are messy. We are fundamentally bad at fighting them. But the premise of the book is that given where we are now in this era of geo-economic conflict, just saying no one wins a trade war and bowing out of the fight is no longer an option. So sadly, reluctantly, the point of the book is to say, you know, given that we do have to engage, what do you need to know? Right? It would be a much shorter book if the answer was no one wins a trade war and we should just, you know, tie our hands and not do anything. It's sadly a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping to open it up and it was just like, that's it. You know, one page, it's over. You can't win. But no, you go through sort of, and it's a really fascinating and a great read. I don't know, I think there's a lot of trade policy books that would be described as page turners, but this is one. So certainly congratulations on that. When you and your co-author Chad Bounce sat down to write this, who were you thinking about as the audience? Is this, is it an audience of one? Is it Donald Trump? Is it Xi Jinping? Is it people who are just kind of caught up in this and trying to make sense of it?
Look, if Donald Trump wants a copy, I will deliver him one in person. I will sign it. I'll sign as many pages as he wants. I'm not sure he's a great reader. I also think it's a little bit optimistic to think that Xi Jinping is going to read it. We did have one suggestion that it might get published in China. But I think the offer came with a condition that they would redact quite a lot about the Chinese system. And we decided that wasn't the point of the book, right? The point of the book was to try and offer something rational in a debate that is, I think, often had between two poles, right? You've got on the one end of the spectrum, you've got people who are saying, look at what President Trump is doing. He's a maniac. He's crazy. He's blowing everything up for no good reason. On the other end of the spectrum, you say, you know, he's a genius. All the tariff wars make perfect sense. And look, I don't think that President Donald Trump has a kind of a full coherent model of the trading system in his mind. That said, there are people working for him now or who have worked for him in the past who I think are right about some of the problems in the global economy. You know, and I suppose the big challenge that I'm talking about is China and the impact of its economic model on the rest of the world. So the book is meant for people who want something that isn't just people yelling at each other, right? Who want a look at the evidence, the history, you know, the stories of trade wars, what we know about what does and doesn't work. And so, you know, we're really hoping for this to be, you know, for a fairly general reader. I think everyone's been quite surprised that for a book about trade policy, there are some jokes in there. But, you know, I was trying really not to make for the other experts. And, you know, the conceit of the book is that you, the reader, come to us, two trade nerds, desperate to fight a trade war, right? And we're the nerds who kind of walk you through this how-to guide. And that might seem a bit weird and confusing because most people aren't that excited about fighting a trade war. But the point is to give you the reader agency, right? To make you a player in this battle, because it, you know, can so easily be very, you know, disempowering. So to kind of make you feel, okay, you're in the thick of it. You're trying to deal with this messy world. What do you need to know?
Yeah. And certainly we will talk about China. That's, I think, a big, really interesting part of the book is your assessment of China's economic model. But to keep the focus on Trump here for just one more minute, has there been, do you see a difference between Trump 2.0 versus the first time around? You sort of mentioned that there in that last answer that, like, he's got people around him. He's got different people around him, certainly this time than last time. How do you, you know, how would you describe the difference of the second Trump administration on trade policy specifically?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference. So in the first Trump administration, you had this kind of push and pull, right? But fundamentally, the big thing that happened was that there was a break from this idea that China would be treated, you know, the same as many of other of the U.S. trading partners, right? So there was a big increase in tariffs against imports coming directly from China. And that was a fundamental break in U.S.-China trade relations. It was one that wasn't reversed. And, you know, there were a bunch of people who were saying, you know, that the Trump administration was going about it in the wrong way. But actually, ultimately, the diagnosis that China was this challenge was correct. Then I think in the second Trump administration, I think, first of all, the president's own instincts seem to be much more powerful, right? He's kind of, there seems to be more of a disconnect between, you know, the things that he says on social media and then the things that actually happen. I mean, you know, a few weeks ago, a few months ago, President Trump tweeted out that the tariff rate on imports coming in from the EU, I think it was that it would go up to say, it would go up by 10 percentage points. And that never happened. Yeah. They just never did it. He tweeted it, and then the executive order just never came out, or the Federal Register notice. Sorry. And so you've got this kind of slightly more obvious push and pull between what the president says and then what his apparatus actually does. But then also, I think there was this difference in you know, obviously the scope and the breadth of President Trump's trade wars. Right. You know, this time. He really did start a trade war with everyone by imposing tariffs so broadly. And that signal was, I think, a bit less clear. Now, you know, I think under the second Trump administration, there has been an increase in the discrimination against products coming in directly from China. So the direction of travel is still broadly the same. But in terms of the, you know, the rhetoric and the signaling, it's much more confused.
Yeah.
And there's a much stronger case that, you know, it's more chaotic, I think, just in terms of what he's trying to do.
And you've seen that push-pull not just in, not behind the scenes so much, but even in public. I mean, they rolled out these huge tariff rates last year on quote-unquote Liberation Day, and then like immediately dialed them back. Basically immediately, within a week, dialed them back, pushed them off, have sort of, you know, gone about it in drips and drabs. One of the things in the book, though, and I think like an analogy that you come back to a couple times in the book is one of a toddler's behavior, which I don't think is an accident, but also not a wrong assessment, I think. You also use this analogy over and over again of like different ships in the sea trading. And I wanted to get you to talk about that for people who haven't read the book, because this was like one of the most useful and accessible analogies, I think, in there for just like understanding the way the US and China and Europe and India are kind of going about this this trade war.
Yeah. Okay. So that's one of my favorite chapters in the book. And so, yeah. So think about governments on, you know, think about them as sailing on fairly choppy seas, right? And so start with the Americans, right? The Americans used to see themselves as this Navy ship patrolling the seas, enforcing the rules-based system, you know, orchestral music playing in the background, that sort of thing. But more recently, they've revealed, you know, what they really are, which is pirates. And so the person who shared this analogy with me suggested that I go and rewatch the film The Pirates of the Caribbean. And they refer me to a scene where the character that Keira Knightley plays complains to the chief pirate. She's like, oh, but it's the pirate code says that this has to happen. And the chief pirate says, well, number one, you are not a pirate. So doesn't apply to you. And number two, it's less of a code and more of a guideline. And it's really that, you know, that sort of is how you need to think about the way that the Trump administration views the you know, the global rules-based system. Okay, so you've got the American pirates. They're, you know, pointing their cannons at everyone. You then have the Chinese, which are this great hulking warship, right? They've got cannons, you know, pointed. They've got dominance over certain manufacturing supply chains. They're not necessarily shooting those guns all the time, but unfortunately, they're not looking very friendly right now. Then you've got the European merchant ship, right? And they haven't got any guns. They're very slow. They're very distressed that everyone's pointing their guns at each other. It's very uncomfortable. They love the rules-based system because, you know, when it's predictable, when it's slow and steady, they can operate well. They don't handle this new, scarier world very well. So you were very kind to highlight this analogy. And I guess I should apologize in advance that I think we do ultimately torture this analogy to death. There are so many boats.
Yeah, I think India is like a car that's been turned into a boat or something like
yeah,
that.
They're like an amphibious vehicle. The Indian, they do that. The Brits are this awkward drifter. We run out of boats. We you know, start asking whose idea this boat thing was anyway. We apologize. But there is actually a serious message in the chapter, right? Because what we're doing is we're running through the incentives of all these boats, right? And they do not have incentives to cooperate. So, you know, let's just take the UK, right? Which is the awkward drifter, used to be tethered to the EU, now doesn't really know where it's rowing. So they want to get cheap stuff from China. They want to stay friends with the US because that's what needs to happen for them to be able to use their nukes. They also want to be close to the Europeans economically because the Europeans are big and rich and they're next door. And so, you know, it might be in the US interests for, say, the UK to join the US in its trade war against China, put up barriers to China, but the UK doesn't want to do that. And you see this dynamic play out and again, right? That the incentives to coordinate and cooperate are just it's really hard to get that to happen. And, you know, one illustration of that is what happened after the Trump administration's tariffs a year ago, right? There were glimmers, there were suggestions that maybe countries would coordinate to push back against the Trump administration, and they went a big fat nowhere. And so you see this kind of difficulty in coordinating, and that's exactly what happens with respect to the Chinese. So just over a year ago, when President Trump threatened tariffs on everyone, he got so much stick for failing to cooperate with allies, for missing the real problem with the global trading system, which was China, for alienating his friends and allies, and for going about the whole thing wrong. But the point of the chapter is to point at all of these other ships and just say how difficult it was to cooperate with those allies, right? And so, you know, maybe we should give the Trump administration a bit less shtick and reframe it to put a bit more of the criticism towards the allies, who actually, historically, arguably in some cases, have been free riding or trying to free ride on the US's efforts to tackle this systemic problem, right? The allies are pretty hard to be coordinated with. So, yeah, you know, big picture point, you know.
They were kind of free riding in this system that the old U.S. naval ship was protecting, that was providing the stability for that system.
You know, China's been a challenge for a while. It's not like anyone else was stepping up to try to enforce the rules-based system. And so, you know, when you suggest that the U.S. should work with allies, you get, you know, an eye roll. It's like, oh, the allies are useless. They never do anything. Now, I think one of the most interesting, you know, things going on right now today in the global trading system is that I think the Europeans may be, you know, arming themselves when it comes to trade wars. So they may be changing slowly because they're still European. But that might be a shift. But it's taken a very long time for them to get there.
Is whatever Europe does here, does that try to re-implement this old rules-based system? Are they the last best hope for that? Because one thing you say over and over again in the book is that that system is dead, is gone, is over and finished and not coming back.
Yeah. I mean, look, the EU already tried to construct some kind of rules-based system to solve disputes, right? So just to let me nerd out here, the US essentially killed the World Trade Organization's system of solving disputes, yeah. right? The Americans were not having it. They were, you know, trusted, broken down. They were not happy the way many of those decisions went. And that was, you know, the kind of the symbolic and also practical, but you know, the symbolic dismantling of the rules-based system. The US wasn't going to pay attention to those judgments anymore. And what the Europeans did is they said, okay, well, why don't we create an alternative, a temporary fix that would sort of, it would work as this kind of international court to settle trade disputes. And we'll set it up and it'll work between as many members as who wants to sign up, right? And so the Europeans signed up, the Chinese signed up, various other countries, lots of countries have signed up. But you still haven't seen the Europeans file, you know, a big trade dispute saying that, you know, China's behavior isn't keeping with the balance of its, you know, rights and obligations when it signed up to the rules in the first place. So you're still seeing a kind of reluctance to really try to use the rules-based system to pursue this systemic problem of China. And I think now the Europeans are, I think, waking up to the fact that it's probably too late, because these kinds of disputes take a really long time.
Yeah.
And you can see that, you know, we're already in a world where China's weaponizing its dominance. You know, suppose the EU were to file some big dispute, it's highly possible that the Chinese would just retaliate immediately. And when you're in that situation, you know, going to, you know, crying to the referee that the Chinese are being mean isn't really going to do much.
Right, especially if America is not participating or is unwilling.
Yeah.
You know, that's a difficult thing too. Like, on one hand, I want to mourn the death or the departure of that old trading system, because I think it was really good for the world. I think it lifted a lot of people out of poverty. I think it's allowed for a lot of prosperity. On the other hand, I feel like maybe those international rules were always sort of fictions anyway. They were only as good as everybody's willingness to follow them in the first place, right? So like, when and how, you identified already like the U.S. And this was under Trump first term, I guess, right? Like sort of dismantling or just disregarding its relationship with the WTO. But like, were there other defining moments in this, the collapse of that system or the collapse of that perceived system that was the sort of the late 20th century into the beginning of the century?
Okay, but just like a couple of caveats quickly before I answer that directly, which is, you know, I don't want to sound naive about how pure the old rules-based system was.
Sure.
Like, number one, the bigger powers were pretty instrumental in rules,
yeah.
Right?
Sure.
It wasn't, you know, the power can be expressed in many different ways. So there was that. You know, obviously now, you know, some of the most vulnerable countries in a return to a power-based system are the smallest, poorest countries. So that's, you know, that's bad news for them. And then, yeah, so answering your question directly, I think there is, you know, the obvious answer would be when, you know, the failure of the Doha round, right? And so
for people who aren't familiar with that,
So the Doha round was this big effort to update the trading rules, right? So the fundamental problem in any system. So imagine in the US that the legislature, so Congress, cannot pass any new laws, right? And so all that happens is that you make the Supreme Court decide everything, right? That's the only way you can
basically what we do,
change. Yeah. It's really not great. It's pretty unsustainable. People get pretty annoyed. And essentially, you know, we created the World Trading System and it was amazing, right? We have 160 plus members and they all have to agree. They all agree, this huge, amazing collective agreement. But if you want to update the rules for everyone, that means everyone also has to agree. And getting 160 plus members to agree is almost impossible, as was demonstrated when the Doha round collapsed, right? There was this big effort at updating the rules, doing another round of trade liberalization, or, you know, advancing the rules, and it didn't happen, right? It was the differences in the member states were too deep. And, you know, that sort of, I think, highlighted that it was just, the rule book, it was too difficult to update, right? And when you feel like, well, you can't update the rule book, and, you know, disagreements are, people are getting increasingly frustrated in the way that disagreements are being settled, then I think it was, you know, maybe only a matter of time before the thing imploded. Because when dissatisfaction builds, you need to change the rules. That's the fundamental structural problem. And that just proved impossible with the structure that we had set up.
Yeah, and so much of this, obviously, and the need to change the rules is so much is wrapped up in China and what China's done over the past few decades. We've alluded to this already. You spell it out pretty clearly in your book. At one point, you're right, I thought this was like the most clear and concise example of it. You said that we worry that China's system is so different from those of its competitors that there isn't space for a common rules-based system. And you really do put a lot of the blame for what's happened on China, ultimately. And you said even earlier in this conversation that America is responding to some of what China's done. I wonder if you could just spell that out for us a bit and tell us, what is it that China's doing that makes it so incompatible with the rest of this pre-existing rules-based system?
You know, China's system has always been a challenge for trade negotiators, right? So, you know, there is a tight-knit relationship between the government and the private sector. And the way that the government hands out support is less transparent than in the West. It's kind of the subsidies, they're in the water. Mm-hmm. It's systemic, right? No one's writing a check to Boeing and saying, you know, have this many million dollars. You know, it's coming in the form of cheap land, cheap credit, regulatory advantages, you know, all sorts of things that are really, really hard to see. So in the rules-based system, what governments tried to do is they tried to limit the use of subsidies in ways that would hurt their trading partners' trade interests, right? It is a mutual restraint, because what you want to avoid is the situation where everyone's pumping their companies with money, and you've just got this very wasteful race. No one's actually getting more productive. It's just a question of, well, who can pump the most money into their companies, right? No one's going to enjoy that. So the idea for the subsidy restraints was that you would place a kind of shared limit on that. And the challenge with China is that the way that they hand out the subsidies, they're just very hard to see because of that close-knit relationship between the state and the private sector. And, you know, trade negotiators tried to write rules that would overcome that, but they didn't work. Ultimately, then China just became too big to sort of brush that away. And you know, ultimately, its system in many areas has generated, you know, near monopolies because of this kind of juggernaut, because of its system, right? And so you've got scenarios where, you know, you've got local governments who are just funneling cheap credit to companies that in any other system would go bankrupt. But the political economy means that they don't. And when there isn't domestic demand, they go out in search of demand overseas. And then when prices collapse in a more market-oriented system, that would be a sign that you should cut production, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't tend to be what happens, or it happens last for the Chinese producers. And so you've got this dynamic where, you know, they can essentially, you know, outcompete everyone else, not because they're the most efficient in every case, but because they've got this support. Now,
and they've broken the price signals there, kind of, right?
That they've broken the price signals.
One of the regulators,
I don't want to, this is really hard to talk about because obviously there are many areas in which China has been enormously successful, and not just because of subsidies, right? They have huge advantages. They have scale. They have an incredibly, huge talent in their population, right? You know, they're innovating. They're really pushing the frontier in many areas, right? So this isn't just a story of the government pumping money, right? That said, you know, that ecosystem, that environment, accentuates this dynamic where you've got this massive country building huge dominance in certain areas of manufacturing that the government has shown that it is willing to weaponize, and that is, you know, a fundamental challenge in the global trading system.
Something else that you talk about is that, and like, so, okay, I tend to think of national security arguments as being what Samuel Johnson said, the last refuge of the scoundrel, right? That like a lot of times national security arguments are cover for really just naked protectionism when governments get involved in some of the things that you talk about in the book, whether it's subsidies or whether it's other sorts of protection for domestic industries. But it seems like you think there is like an actual national security nexus to some of what, maybe not all, and sorry, I think probably certainly not all, but some of what the United States and other European powers are worried about with China. Where, like, how do you start to draw those lines between like what actually is a real national security concern and what isn't? And like, you know, if you're trying to win a trade war, how do you go about that process?
Yeah. So this was actually one of the areas where my co-author Chad Bown and I had massive disagreements. Yeah. And you know, I think the most heated one was to do with connected vehicles, right? Mm. Where obviously the US has banned effectively imported vehicles using Chinese software. And to me, sitting in the UK, where there are plenty of Chinese electric vehicles on the roads, this seemed a bit much, right? Because, you know, some of the concerns were like, oh, well, what if I, the chief economist at the US State Department, is driving a Chinese EV, then it can surveil me. And I was like, fine, if you're a US government official, don't buy any Chinese EV. It doesn't seem that hard. You know, banning all Chinese EVs from the country seems like an overreaction to that concern. And you know, we had these heated arguments, and I said, you know, if you're going to stop banning EVs because of these risks, then why aren't we banning smartphones? Yeah. They're made in China last time I checked.
I guess your smartphone isn't going to drive you off a cliff unexpectedly.
Yeah,
there was the kill switch risk,
which, yeah, you know, I think is real. We've, you know, seen reports of these things being included in other products. Having done, you know, I think where we landed was this, you know, that particular area was deeply uncomfortable. And to an extent, you know, the whole point is that we, you know, this is the awful thing about these national security arguments, which is that they're being fought by securocrats who do not generally enjoy sharing all the evidence that they have. And so this kind of has to be maybe an area where the security types, you know, say, no, we're really worried. You shouldn't have these things. And, you know, having done a bit more reporting, I'd say, you know, I wonder whether actually the direction of travel in the UK is going to be towards the US. I don't think it was so here in the UK, when I've asked around, I'm not hearing, oh yes, those idiot American protectionists. Hmm. That's not the impression I get. So I think with some of these cases, you know, there is sensible people are concerned, and you know, I'm obviously haven't been privy to those conversations. I will say that Chad went into the State Department and came out much more scared than he was when he went in. He was very annoyingly refused to tell me anything that anything specific that he learned.
He's got to share that with the co-author. Come on, that's.
There is a kind of a different way into this national security piece that I think might be worth mentioning. So, because there's the micro security risks like surveillance, kill switches, that kind of thing. And there's also the kind of macro industrial base concern, right? And that is, you know, if there is a war, is it healthy for 50%? I mean, China's not there now, but you know, it could be there on current trends, given you know the expansion of its manufacturing sector. Is it healthy for upwards of, you know, 50% of global manufacturing to be concentrated in one country? So you know, I'm very skeptical of the like, but for national security, we must make everything at home, right? That's not, I don't instinctively buy that argument. But I do get a bit nervous about so much industrial capacity being located in one place. And the argument with US industrial capacity was often, okay, we don't have the industrial capacity on our own in a kind of big conflict. But look, with allies, we actually have quite a lot of industrial capacity, right? So that fundamental point of actually we want something combined with allies to scale up if there was some kind of conflict. I don't completely discount that argument. And that is, I think, you know, in Europe, right, where you're seeing real pain in say Germany's industrial base, you know, that I'm a bit more nervous about, right? If the dynamic changes, so it's not like, oh, don't worry, the US can rely on the combined industrial base of its allies, right? If everyone's industrial base is shrinking, then I guess I'm just a bit less sanguine.
Well, so, and that's like, yeah. I remember when Trump did the steel and aluminum tariffs, one of the first things he did back in the first term, right? And like the national security was the justification for that, supposedly. And it's like, well, okay, we don't make all the aluminum we use here in the US, but we also import a ton of it from Canada. And if there's a war that disrupts our imports from Canada, I don't know, you've got a much bigger problem on your hands, it feels like, at that point. So that's where I mean, like, these things, at least to me, they seem like they're often overblown, even when they do have I mean, you need aluminum to fight a war. You got to build guns and bombs and planes and things like that. But I don't know how you like start to figure out when it's real and when it's, and the Trump administration has made it hard to figure out when it's real and when it's not.
Yeah, totally. I think if you're worried about a war with Canada, that's probably a sign that the protectionists got the upper hand in that argument. So I do still think that, you know, when it comes to that, you know, industrial base argument, then it does matter, you know, who your allies are. And, you know, if it becomes like, oh, we just have to make everything at home, that to me is a red flag, because I think if, you know, in an actual national security situation, and I suppose, you know, the more you're talking about a specific product, right? If we're talking about general manufacturing capacity, then that argument is more powerful to me. Like, it doesn't necessarily need to be in a particular kind of steel that, you know, maybe some US manufacturer is really, you know, good at compared to their Canadian rivals. Yeah, so I mean, you know, the challenge there is obviously then I can be kind of hand wavy at the macro level and then start to criticize any individual micro level. So it's, you know, it's easy to be hypocritical.
Sure.
But, you know, I think identifying who your allies are and having a kind of coherent position across products in the aggregate is what I would try to do.
Yeah, and building up that trust. We talked about this already, but it's difficult to trust a pirate too, right? Like, we've also made it more difficult to trust our allies and to have that relationship. And even though it may be a challenge, I think we've made it harder in some ways. I thought one of the things that you did really well in the book too is to point out kind of exactly what you're saying here, is that, like, we kind of don't know, and everything is, it's there's less certainty, I think, about some of these things. Certainly there's less certainty than the politicians would like, or than they like to say. And so I guess as we sort of head towards wrapping up here, I have to ask, like, what does a global trading system look like in this reality where you've got fewer rules, WTO kind of doesn't matter anymore, you got pirates and warships out there on the high seas? Like, how does the system, does it get worse than now, or do we kind of, reach towards some new consensus that will form?
You know, the beginning of the book, set up these ships, right? And then a lot of the book is describing, you know, what I think the tools are going to be, right? And what we do and don't know about how to use them and so on and so forth. And so there's just, you know, this huge journey that you go on as a reader. And then in the final chapter, I try to do a bit of, you know, looking forward, right? So I've got these scenarios of what the future trading system could look like. And unfortunately, some of them are quite a long way into the distance, because I'm not actually that optimistic about our capacity to, you know, solve these in one big grand bargain. And maybe the one furthest off into the distance is the one where we do manage to make some kind of deal, right? And that is based on this idea that, you know, maybe we get to a position where everyone just has, you know, massive fragmentation, massive trade barriers against anyone else, huge erosion of trust. We just, you know, we're not cooperating at all. I'm still hopeful in this scenario that we've avoided World War III, and, you know, well done us if we've done that. And so, you know, in that world, you know, so one idea that is in there is this kind of new institution. It's called the Organization for Watching Liabilities. And there the idea is that, look, we're not in a world in which, you know, one superpower is going to maintain stability forever after, right? We're in this kind of world of geoeconomic conflict. And so maybe the best we can do is come up with some arrangement that would limit the fallout as the players try to minimize their over-dependencies on the other players, right? So you have this organization for watching liabilities that is this neutral organization that identifies when a particular product is facing this kind of dangerous market dominance, right? So sort of like an international competition authority, right? You've got this monopolist in, say, rare earths. They're all being made in China. It's a problem. And then once you've identified that that is an area where there is this kind of dangerous dominance, basically all bets are off, right? So in those areas, no rules apply. Turn back to all the tools that we've been discussing elsewhere in the book. And for everything else, maybe we can get some kind of semblance of a rules-based system back.
Just to kind of constrain where the war is taking place, or
yeah,
constrain
maybe
what
the best
sort
we
of...
can hope for is just to is because really what we don't want is tit for tat escalation that could end up in something much worse than a trade war, could end up in a real war, right? And so maybe some vision of the future is kind of constraining those dynamics. So yeah, in the US, the subtitle of the book is An Optimistic Guide to an Anxious Global Economy. And we have received a bit of shtick for putting the word optimistic in there because, parts of it aren't that optimistic. And I do think it's optimistic, right? I do think there are things we can do. I do think we have some agency. There are ways that I think we need to reframe the debate to get to a more constructive place. I think there are lessons that we have to learn from China. There are lessons we can all learn from each other. So I do think it's optimistic, but in the kind of narrow predictive sense of where we're headed, I'm not sure a big trade deal is going to save us anytime soon.
Yeah, I was going to give you a little bit of shtick about the optimistic subtitle there too, because it's like it's an optimistic guide to an anxious global economy. I get a lot more anxiety, I think, out of this conversation. You just kind of casually tossed off there, well, hopefully we avoid World War III. Like those are, and you're clear about this in the book too, like that really is kind of the stakes here. Like there is a reality where this spirals further. And so maybe the optimism is, I mean, it sounds terrible to say, but like the optimistic take is we avoid that terrible outcome. How, like, what does that look like? I guess we should at least briefly explore that road. What's the choices that we need to be careful not to make in the future to avoid that tit for tat escalation that takes us somewhere, somewhere terrible? Maybe, I guess, it's out of our hands in some regard. Like, it's China will get to make those decisions. Other countries will get to make those decisions too. But what does that route look like?
I mean, it looks bad.
Yeah.
World War III. Not great. For the second chapter, looking at this, the stakes of peace, I spoke to some people who who were experts in nuclear war, right? So I interviewed folks who laid out in great detail, the kind of apocalyptic horrors that would happen in that situation. And the way that you get from trade wars to real wars is miscommunication. I also don't want to overplay the role of trade nerds, right? We trade nerds, we love to think that it's all about us, right? And actually, the real drivers of war are much more complicated. It would be quite unusual historically if it was just trade tensions that generated an actual war. That said, there are, there's a bit in the stockpiling chapter, for example, where we talk about how, you got to worry, because if you start energetically building a stockpile, a trading partner might interpret that as you preparing for a military conflict, right? There are historical examples with, the Japanese, the Nazis, when they were stockpiling, and that was a sign that they were preparing for something bad. So you've got to be really careful the signals that you're sending to other governments. I think there's a really interesting debate going on right now about, how much of what China is doing is really just a response to what the US is doing. Because if it is, then maybe the US has more agency, right? Maybe they can lower the temperature. I worry that, it's too late to do that. It risks just naivety to hope that we can put the genie back in the bottle and get back to a world in which we all trust each other and can, trade peacefully. I hope Taiwan it's okay. But you know, I got very scared writing that chapter, looking at those outcomes.
Yeah, and it sounds like a last thing here, we'll get you out on this, and we've got a little fun tidbit as well. But the you know, this sounds like everything you're saying is that this really goes beyond Donald Trump. Obviously, so much of the trade war is tied up in what Trump's policies have been, and he's been kind of the most vocal advocate for it. But there will be a day when he is no longer the most prominent figure in America's political stage and in the world. Is there like one thing you could advise the next president, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter, whoever comes next, what's like the one most important thing they should do if they want to follow your advice and how to win a trade war?
Be focused. Fight the right trade war, because Donald Trump started a lot of them. You know, we can see right now, right? The American public is pretty upset about affordability. Tariffs are not looking particularly popular. The danger is that we lurch back in the other direction and conclude that actually we can't afford to fight the you know, the trade wars that really do need fighting.
Best way to win a trade war is to pick the right one, I suppose, at the beginning. Mm-hmm. That's important. Samaya Keynes, thank you so much for talking to us. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I believe we have, you also have your ukulele with you. You are a musician on the side, amateur musician, and you're going to treat us maybe to a song?
Oh, I would be absolutely delighted to.
So how do you win a trade war? By blowing up the world, by terrifying with tariffizing, by stopping what you serve. Why not try this battle cry, singing high, oh, high, oh, hey. Why not try this battle cry, singing high, oh, high, oh, hey. So how do you win a trade war? By engaging with the fight. Don't pretend that we're all friends. Subsidize and strategize. Look at your ties, work with allies. Economize as you build supplies. You've got to do the work. Oh, why not try this battle cry, singing high, oh, high, oh, hey.
'Cause we're all trade warriors now, whether we like it or not.
Why not try this battle cry, singing high, oh, high, oh, hey. Singing high, oh, high, oh, hey.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much. That was great. You're getting some applause from the booth over here too. So,
oh, that's nice.
I would say don't quit your day job, but I mean that in the best way possible. I mean that like we need you to continue doing your day job. It's very important too. But if you ever had to, you got a good backup plan there. Thank you so much for talking to us. This was great.
That was excellent. Like this was genuinely one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh,
thank you
great.
So much.
Like, that means a lot.
For reading the book and yep. for like, yeah, thank you.